the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. When people start talking about stories that when they knew you at university, you get slightly nervous, don't you? you're very gentle. We didn't go into anything dodgy, did we?
Well, yesterday I said that you've played The Long and Winding Road and you're in dispute that you've ever played that song on the piano.
Well, yeah, something by the Beatles, probably. I managed to find this battered old piano and haul it up into my rooms at Oxford and, play. And Steve was a captive audience at one point, yeah.
There I was. Paul, we're great to have you here. We want to just pull out a bit of, other than the fact that we've met each other at university, to say who you are. Yeah. You're the chief executive officer of something called the Bible Society. Can you tell us what the Bible Society is?
Yeah. We've been going, I mean, I joined the organisation 9 years ago, but it's been going for 220-something years. Some of you will know the story of Mary Jones, which became written up as a children's story, which was kind of the founding experience that kicked off Bible Society. She was a 15-year-old girl in Wales who wanted a Bible in 1800, walked 26 miles, having saved for 6 years to buy one, got to the town of Barla and went to the home of this man called the Reverend Thomas Charles that she knew should have some Bibles, and he didn't have any. He eventually, of course, he got some and he gave some to her. But it provoked him to think, why is it so difficult to get Bibles for people who want them? And why are they so expensive? So he then had conversations with people like William Wilberforce and eventually people like Lord Shaftesbury got involved. And they started up the Bible Society to address this problem so that everyone in the world in the end. They started off with Wales and then the kingdom, as in the United Kingdom. And then it became, well, why not the world? You know, what the Victorians were like, or the proto-Victorians. And so it became an organisation that really drove a massive investment in translating the Bible into hundreds and hundreds of languages, innovating in print and distribution technologies to make it cheaper and easier for people to get it. When we started, less than 10% of the population of the planet, it's estimated, had access to a Bible in a language they could understand. And today, that number is over 90%. So, it's been a very long journey, and other organizations have joined in the effort. We continue to try to get that from 90, whatever it is, up to 100%. But what we've seen is it's also important to actually read it.
So I'm intrigued by the words we said earlier today. Yeah. It's called the Bible Society. There are two words there, Bible and society. And it strikes me that the work of the Bible Society today is less, I mean, it's still about trying to get the Bible into people's hands and make it accessible. But it's also about asking questions about society and what's going on, and how can this speak to that, which is at the heart of why I became a Christian, because I thought I didn't want to become religious. I wanted to get involved in something that was going to change me and change the world. And would you say that's a lot of what you're now involved
in? That is totally. We're still doing the bread and butter, but actually what we've realized is it's really important because the Bible brings such change, such transformation in people's lives, and then their relationships and their communities and their societies, when they actually read it and encounter Jesus as the author, and it brings incredible change. So, yeah, we're working very much at helping people see that connection between the Bible and everyday life, and indeed the big issues that we all are concerned with in our societies.
And I think if you come here this evening, thank you so much for coming again, and you're not a regular churchgoer, that might seem a very odd thing to say, that the Bible can make a difference to society. And I guess, at heart, that's what we want to have a conversation about this evening, two things work. So, tell me, as someone who's engaged in connecting faith to society, to the issues that you see around in the world, we all read the news, we all are aware of the news, but your role in part is to observe trends within the world. So I wonder if you could tell me what's driving your work at the moment, what you're observing.
Well, I suppose at the simple level, that you could say the Bible is trending. We've seen so many celebrities. You know, you think of Kaio Saka, you know, footballers, Bear Grylls, but public intellectuals too. People like Tom Holland and Jordan Peterson, atheists talking about the Bible and its value for individuals, for communities, for society, really asking profound questions. And then, of course, Christians being more willing than they have been for a long time, perhaps, to talk about their faith and the impact of the Bible in their own lives in public. So I think that's one thing that we've definitely observed in recent times. And I suppose we see that it's very marked in Britain, but we see it also in other countries around the world, particularly in the West, a very similar dynamic. But there's an openness in the younger generation, actually all over the world, to seek meaning, purpose. Why am I here? What's going on? I had an extraordinary experience coming back from a conference with Bible agencies in Malaysia. My plane was cancelled. You know, I had a horrible night's sleep, as you do, and managed to get myself on the next flight and was stuck next to, in the middle seat. You know, it wasn't what I'd booked, for sure, for whatever it was, like 13 hours. But the young man next to me was a Muslim who'd been to Quran school, and he just wanted to start talking about his search and how he was dissatisfied. And he had, when he realized that I knew a little bit about the Bible, he was asking me, he was just peppering me with questions about the Bible. Where's that bit that talks about love? Was his question. So this is something that's happening around the world, I think, Steve. But I think that part of the reason it's happening, in the West at least, in Britain in particular, is that we've kind of come to the end of the road of an experiment that we started 60-odd years ago of saying, well, our culture's been built on the Bible for a long time, over 1,000 years, but all kinds of terrible things happened in a row. Two world wars, Auschwitz, Hiroshima, and it seemed like that the arrogance of leaders and of the culture at that time had led us to that, and Christianity was sort of associated with it because it was the establishment faith. And so there was a kind of rejection of all of those things and anyone trying to tell us, you know, what the right way to be was. And we had that period that we know well, because it's all been about get rid of any authority, any story that tells us how we should live. And it's all about the individual pursuing their own vision of life. And we thought that that would give us freedom and liberation. And for a while it sort of did, but it started to go sour. And I think we've reached the point where we've really realized it's not working. It's kind of hollow. And we're all liberated to be individuals, but we're lonely. I mean, that's the most profound thing, I think, in our societies, is this extraordinary isolation, fragmentation of community, relationships, families, and loneliness that results. And so I think that's the underlying trend, if you like, that's driving some of these manifestations in public a greater willingness to search again, to ask questions again, to say, well, did we throw the baby out with the bathwater? Perhaps we shouldn't have let go of everything in Christianity the way we did. But can we go back, and where do we go now?
So in a way, you're talking about the fact that through events in the last 50, 60 years, there's a loss of certainty that people had before that, a foundation. And they rejected that certainty because they thought there was a freedom that which this certainty had been restricting them from. But in embracing the freedom, you find that there's no solid ground to actually stand upon. So suddenly people who've lost certainty are looking for something they can trust, something that they can put their confidence in again. And the Bible, for us, is right in the middle of that conversation.
Yeah, and of course it's difficult because we've lost trust in so many things and so many institutions, and often for understandable reasons. You know, we've all felt really let down by leaders and institutions, and that's what's really hard. Is there anything really reliable, really authentic, really real that I can trust? And I think that's a cry of this time, of this generation.
Yeah, and I think for me personally as well, not only is that out there, but it's also in here. I'm not sure if I can trust myself sometimes yes. as well. Ask my wife, it's very true. You shouldn't trust me very much in that way. But there's a degree in which I'm not sure whether I can follow through on everything, and I know I fall short. And I'm trying to find something that's going to get me through in this way. And that, I guess, is part of this as well.
I think it is. I think that what's been striking to me is, and it's incredibly tragic, but I mean, it's something I've had direct experience of in my own wider family, is the number of younger people, I mean, who reach the end of the road and feel like there's nowhere to go and feel like they want to end it all. And the stories they tell of that and of then actually often having a dramatic experience is the sort of stories that we're having, hearing many times, which is both encouraging but also very tragic. But in those moments of desperation, people having an experience of God coming to them and speaking to them and helping them turn away from that sort of giving them a reason, I suppose, to understand that they are loved and that there's a purpose.
And that dovetails very much with the research that your organisation has just done. I don't want to assume that you know about this research. It has been in the national press. It's been called various different things in different stories. But would your organisation has come up with a phrase, the quiet revival, for
yes.
what you're describing. Can you just take us through a little bit about...
Should we use this? We've got a few slides. Should we do that?
Well, as if by magic, I believe we have. Who came up with the phrase the quiet revival? Do you know?
I think it was. I think it was somebody in. It wasn't me. I'll tell you that. It wasn't me. I think it was someone in the research team. Yeah, but just sort of grappling with when we got this data, our research team are top notch, and they weren't sure it was reliable. They were like, this is too good to be true, and they went back to the survey company we commissioned, which is again. Top-notch survey company called YouGov, and said, are you sure about this? And they were saying, well, gosh, yeah, and, you know, gosh, that's really surprising. So they went and checked everything. And it was only when everything had been, like, triple-checked that we said, okay, we can't... This seems to be what people are actually saying. We can't find anything methodologically wrong with this, so we're going to publish it. And it totally took us by surprise how viral it went, because the findings are so counterintuitive, according to what we've all got used to being told is the pattern of things, which is the sort of slow, graceful, inevitable decline of Christianity in the West. Yeah. Shall I say a bit about it? So I think for me, the chart to focus on here, this is kind of the milieu in which we're doing this work. But the one in the bottom middle with the sort of Google searches, and see that spike in COVID. I think for me, COVID was an experience which really kind of unveiled something for many, many people, where they suddenly realized the emptiness, the hollowness of the sort of, what I would call the false gods of our age. The things we've put our hope in instead of God that we think will kind of get us through, the things we always could rely on. And suddenly, when we're faced with this awful disease, and we all, you know, if you can put your, because we've kind of all forgotten about it now that we've got the vaccines and everything. But if you put yourself back into the space of what it felt like in those early days of lockdown, I think it just had such an impact on the country. And that's where you can see, and other countries, this spike in, there's got to be another answer, people searching. So you'll notice that our research kind of is before and after COVID. It's like a new dating system. And we have been, obviously, being Bible-focused, we really want to understand attitudes to the Bible. So we wanted to do this in an evidence-based way. We did a massive survey in 2018, nearly 20,000 people, which most of the surveys, you, some of you will know too well how significant this sample size is. But most of the surveys you read that make the national press are 2,000 or 3,000 people. So this is a huge sample, and we did that because we wanted to have confidence in the detail of the answers, and not just a few headlines that we could be confident in. 2022, we did the small sample just to see where we were at, and we thought, oh, this is interesting. There's a lot more uncertainty. Something's happening, don't know what. But 2024, we went back, did another big survey. So what the report, the Quiet Revival, all the big findings are the comparison between where we were in 2018 and where we were in 2024. So that's what I'm going to quickly show you. Three main findings. Church is growing and changing, and that's like already a bit of a bomb, because the church is meant to be declining in the mainstream narrative. That it's impactful, and that there's a new climate, a new openness in society, and that's what we've really found. So this is what everyone kind of assumed. This was the received wisdom, was that the church was basically getting older. Every generation, every new generation, there were fewer and fewer people interested, and the church was basically old. And it doesn't say on here, but that it's about, in at that moment in time, 60-65% female. So that was the sort of perception. But when we did the same survey, same questions, same methodological robustness in 2024, this was the answer we got. And you can see just how radically different that is. And so suddenly, you've got this growing engagement with church happening at the top end of the age spectrum, so the older people, but actually in particular amongst the younger generations, and the younger you get, the more extreme that change is. And the folk who are the sort of the laggards in this, sort of my age group, Gen Xers, where you're seeing a relative decline. But overall, what this shows, what this represents, is 2 million more adults regularly attending church. Church going is identified, defined in all of these charts as people who believe, they have to say they believe, and they have to go to church at least once a month or more. So this is not nominal Christianity. Our research actually shows nominal Christianity continuing to decline, like the census does. We actually have lower numbers than the census. This is active Christianity. So what we're seeing is nominal Christianity declining, active Christianity growing, particularly amongst younger age groups. Male and female, it's slightly higher percentage with young men, but it's also young women. So some of the media reports tend to, for political reasons, slant it in one way or another. But it's actually right across the country, right across the denominations. It's not particular to a place or a particular kind of church. And the church is now more racially diverse than the country as a whole. And its average age is younger than the country on average, which is remarkable. What we find, too, is that on all these measures of well-being, church-going, people who go to church tend to say that they feel a greater sense of purpose, they feel less anxious on a number of these sorts of questions, and then also they're much more likely to give to others, to work, to volunteer their time, to get involved in a food bank, to help do environmental, contribute to environmental projects or contribute to their local area. So there's an action involved, that faith makes a difference in the way people experience life and what they do and how they connect with their local community. And then That's the church-going side of it, but then there's a broader finding about a new atmosphere. This is the sort of baseline that we've seen for a long time. It's something that everyone at Bible Society has to understand, this data, because, of course, we want to change this. But we're a country that's been steeped in Christianity for generations. There are Bibles galore available, free on the internet. But, you know, 80% of people hardly ever or never have read it. And a lot of those say they're not interested either. So there's a lot of indifference to the Bible. But that's the average. In the younger generation, it's radically different situation. Look at these statistics. You can read them better than I can, but there's a spike in belief in God, a willingness to go to church, particularly if invited by a friend or a family member, to read the Bible if invited, wanting to discover more about the Bible and faith. Overall, this is just one generation, but overall, the spiritual openness in the country is about a third of all adults that have these sorts of attitudes, where there's an openness and an interest. So it's a remarkable shift in the climate. Yeah.
We're saying these are young adults, largely. I'm wondering, what do you think they're looking for when they're going back to the Bible, when they're saying, someone's asked me to church, when they go, what are they hoping for, do you think?
Well, it's important to say that a significant minority, it probably is a minority, but a significant minority, are almost encountering God without even going to church. So they're having an experience, perhaps through a moment of extremity. I mean, and sadly, I've heard many people talk about of being right on the edge of a suicide attempt and having an encounter with God that stops them, and then they come to church. Or they read the Bible on their own. Maybe it's a family Bible that they feel prompted to read, and they encounter Jesus themselves and then come to church. They're reading about the Bible and finding Bible content online and kind of being partly discipled online, if you like. Church leaders shudder at this report, but it's true. And then they come to church. So quite often, folk are having an encounter with God because they're going out by themselves, having an experience, encountering Jesus, not being sure what it is, searching, reading the Bible, looking online, and then figuring out, I need to go to church. And that's extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Well, what's really interesting there is that you can read all your research and think, oh, this is interesting. Social trends are changing, and maybe because of COVID, this is what's happening. But the implication of what you just said is that actually there's something beyond social trends, that God might be doing something.
I
know that might sound strange to people here, but that's exciting to me.
I said this when we did the press launch, and we had no idea how viral it was going to go. We had a lot of media people in the room, and I also wrote the foreword of the report. And I implored people, because I knew all the questions that I got and that the panel got, the research team, were all about basically sociology, demographics, methodology, statistics, all of this. And that's fair enough. I knew that would come. But what I implored them was, look, this is more than just a sociological trend. You've got to get out and actually talk to people, which we'd done. And so we knew, and we'd also heard from so many church leaders by then who were saying, oh, yeah, we had this incredible one or two people or three or four people, depending on how big the church was. When you add up those, that's why partly why we called it the Quiet Revival, but you added up those numbers, it was very significant. But we knew there was a phenomena here. And so I was imploring people, this is God is doing something that's touching people's hearts. But in answer to the question, I mean, we've got a few young people in the room. We should probably ask them, shouldn't we? But without putting them on the spot.
I promise you not to do that.
But when we've asked, you know, and the research asked people, and you've probably seen some, the ITV did a brilliant, like a whole week, when they went around the country interviewing people in every region of the ITV television regions. Why are you in church? And they got the same sort of answers that we've had. which is often a search for community and belonging, a search for meaning and purpose, and a desire that's expressed about transcendence, mystery. Isn't there something more than just what we experience? Because it feels like there should be. And is there? Is that feeling that there's more, can I find that?
To me, the most exciting thing about that is you've talked about three different things there.
Yeah.
But there's a kind of triangulation between them that says that actually it's not just belonging that you want. For me, belonging is great. We want belonging. But we also want meaning. We want somewhere that you belong which brings meaning. And we want somewhere that belongs and has meaning because it's based on something which is above and beyond the other things that we can't trust in at the moment.
We've tried pretty much everything that we can think of, haven't we, in terms of human effort, wealth, technology, science. And it's precisely that that led us into the disasters of the 20th century, in a way. It was our hubris that we thought we could solve all our problems by ourselves. So, yeah, I think, yeah, something that actually is bigger than us.
And for anyone who's thinking, well, yeah, but what about Christianity? Just remind me, is it G.K. Chesterfield? I think it is. He said, it's not that Christianity has been tried and found wanting, it's that it hasn't been tried.
Yeah, Chesterton,
And I think that's a really interesting result. So the challenge to me, to us, if you're a follower of Jesus, is that you better try it, not just talk about it along the way as we go. So meaning, belonging, transcendence, I've said, but what does faith in Jesus specifically bring to those from your point of view?
It's crucial. And one of the things that struck me in the intellectual conversation with the sort of public atheists, the Jordan Peterson, Douglas Murray's, Tom Hollands. And I think that their contribution has been incredibly helpful because I think it's an honest one. It's a grappling with the kind of what's happened in Western culture and the dead end we've reached. And I remember listening to Roger Scruton, the late philosopher, talking about, you know, when you get down a cul-de-sac, the intelligent thing to do is to turn around and come back out again. This was in a debate with Francis Fukuyama on his book called The End of History. He said, yeah, it's a dead end though, Francis. Yeah. The thing is, what you can't do, which I think some of these intellectuals kind of think you can do, is get all the goody stuff out of Christianity by having the story and the values and the culture. You can't have that without the reality that gives it life. And it's the relationship with Jesus which is the reality that gives it life. I don't think that the young generation are going to fall for that, though, you see. I think it's a gift because there's, and unlike many of us where we've grown up with this sort of a little bit of a split between faith that's personal and relational on the one hand, and kind of society having it, running itself kind of by human reason. Of course, the Bible doesn't do that. The Bible's got it all integrated. And I think that the younger generation are absolutely, if it's real, if it's authentic, then it has to connect things up. And that's what happens when we encounter Jesus, because we encounter we not just a teacher with wisdom, but we begin to discover that this is God with power, and we experience it. And God comes, as Jesus promised when he, you can read about this in the beginning of Acts, right? When he ascended into heaven, and he told his disciples to wait, and he was going to send the Holy Spirit. And the Holy Spirit is how God makes himself, how Jesus makes himself known to every one of us. And we can know that personally. And it's that dynamic when we know we're encountering the reality of a transcendent God, but we're encountering his love incredibly intimately and personally in a way that's interested in the micro details of our lives and cares about it. and can bring change. That's the game changer, not the intellectual stuff. Although, you know, that's important, especially for intellectuals. I'm not diminishing it, but that's not the life-changing thing. That's not going to keep you going. What really keeps you going is that knowing the experience of being loved by a loving God so personally. So I think that's what... that's why I'm still a Christian. Because when you started with that story, I don't know if I was walking with God at that time.
You're walking with Paul McCartney, I
suppose. Was it with Paul McCartney? But because I had an encounter that brought me back to faith,
right?
Sort of, just as I was in the middle of my undergraduate degree.
Yeah. I'm thinking what you're saying. It's really interesting. It's like, you know, you see films where someone's in a cave and the way out is blocked up with rocks and you can't get out. And to me, Christian faith is a bit like you're trying through this tunnel and the way out's blocked out. And actually, I keep throwing more stones on the thing that's blocking it up. It's getting more blocked up all the time. And you say that human ways of doing things, there's a dead end there that you're going towards that we all face. But somehow, at the heart of our faith, isn't it, is that the rocks that we're throwing are dealt with somehow by a cross, which deals with all the rocks that have been thrown there, and this explosive dynamite of a resurrection that bursts through the rocks and says, right, there's a way through this. So that instead of living in a cul-de-sac, you suddenly live in a thoroughfare, and there's a way forward as in the way in which you go there. And I get so excited about that, because that's true on the big scale, but it's also true on the personal scale. When you know that you're stuck, I think my faith is the fact that the power of God, it finds a way through when you keep throwing those rocks in there. Does that make sense, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, the amazing thing about... the cross is such an unlikely thing for us to focus on. And because, of course, in the ancient world, it was the most shameful way that anyone could die and be executed. And... it was sort of a source of derision and mockery, really. So why on earth would the Christians, the early Christians, make it the centre? And I think it was just the understanding that God had done something utterly unexpected and utterly dramatic, which was, instead of responding to all of the wickedness, the evil, the hatred... that was thrown Jesus' way, but that we all throw at one another, and even at ourselves, don't we? We do it to ourselves too. Actually, God's solution wasn't to kind of bring a judgment that just wiped everyone out, which was kind of and started again, but to absorb it all, to take it all on and absorb it in love. Yeah. And that is the life that we're invited into. But it requires letting go of staying angry, of being harboring unforgiveness against yourself or others, and being willing to turn and, you know, live the Jesus way, which is a way of unqualified love.
So we've talked about challenges in society, and we could look at the news at the moment. We see those challenges all around us. The world's becoming more and more divided and complex. Our society's facing serious challenges, and yet in the middle of this, we're seeing a stirring, if you like, of something. What do you think in that context, and given everything we've said, what do you think really are the main challenges and opportunities that we have at the moment? And particularly, what can this quirky thing called the church, which seems dusty and old-fashioned, at least in many people's eyes, actually have for the world that we live in today?
I think it's a very challenging time that we're in. It's a very contended moment, because I think we've got this... the lid's kind of come off that... it's hard for many people, many public leaders, to sort of admit it, but we kind of are at a dead end. We don't really know what to do, how to move forward. And into that vacuum come all kinds of new competing ideas, political ideologies and movements. And meanwhile, just stuff isn't working, you know, and we can sort of feel it. And we'll all have things that we'll notice more than others, but we can feel that what was quite firm and stable maybe 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago that we can sort of, we thought we could rely on, suddenly doesn't feel reliable anymore. And that's true not just within, let's say, a small country like Britain, but geopolitically it seems like anything could happen, you know. And for a long time it's felt quite, at least we live in a calm, predictable part of the world. But the chaos seems to be coming nearer, and what are we going to do about that? How are we going to live together? And we're getting more and more fractured. So I think it's a very, very dangerous time. And bizarrely, I do think that this sort of very unlikely rabble of the church holds the answer. And I hope, I suppose my hope is that we as, you know, speaking sort of as a Christian, that we as Christians don't allow the sort of new spiritual openness to it, for faith to become co-opted by some of these other ideologies and movements, but that we actually have the confidence to say, we don't have the answers, but we know some, you know, it's like the AA, we know a man who does, you know. And actually, can we not try to go back to the way things were, but a fresh expression of the vitality of Christian faith could revitalize our societies, is my belief. And I think that this quiet revival is a sign of hope for us that God is coming near. He's come near. And he's come near because he's giving us the opportunity to respond again as a society. And his way is a way of love. It's not a way of hate and division. So we're going to have to be willing to overcome whatever particular prejudices we might have towards others, and we all have them. Because Christ's way is the way of love. And can that be something that can bring healing? I believe it's the only thing that can bring healing. And I believe this is a moment for us to be appropriately, winsomely confident as God's people in that. Yeah.
We're going to have a moment for you to ask questions. We've got, it's 7:45, we want to finish at 8, it's Saturday night, you're all going out dancing later, so, but we're going to answer some
questions.
Thought
you never asked me. Oh,
so there's some questions in a moment, and so just to give you a couple of minutes notice about that. But it's interesting what you say, I think, that humility in there is such a hugely important thing, it seems to me, that we don't... that the way forward is not to shout loudly and claim centre ground, but actually to serve and to be all the fruit of the spirit stuff we like to call kind and gentle and sacrificial and go that extra mile. The other thing that strikes me is that the uncertainties that we've got at the moment, you could say, well, what we want to do is to get back to when things felt more certain. So wouldn't it be good if we could get back to 1952 or whatever it was, where everything was... Life was simpler back then, wasn't it? Just get back to there and everything would be fine. But actually, when everything was kind of fine on the surface, we were less awake to who God was in a real way. And at the moment, as this carpet's being pulled from under our feet, well, what do you trust in? What do you really trust in?
It's dangerous to have that sort of golden era mentality of getting back to something, because we have messed up as a Christian community, and we've often messed up the worst when we've had more political power. Not always, but that's just... So we of all people have a story that should make us willing to be honest about that and humble about it. So I think that, the humility is very important, that people... that what we present... is not church institutions, but it's actually the life of Jesus Christ, which is the hope for our nation, for the healing of all the divisions that we have, and for the flourishing of people. We've got terrible inequality that's grown and grown and grown in my lifetime in this country. It's absolutely scandalous, isn't it, the number of people who are needing to rely on things like food banks. And, you know, at one level we can say the church is the main institution that's providing those food banks and that's welcoming the refugees. That's true, but wouldn't it be great if we didn't actually need food banks? That would be a better solution. So how can we, you know, that's the kind of question that I think we want to lean into as a community and ask God for wisdom. Have we got the humility to actually go and pray about some of these things? That may seem very... I'm actually a professional economist for 15 years prior to what I'm doing now. But, you know, I think that so much of economic flourishing is to do with our hopes and dreams, our characters. That so affects how we work and how fruitful we can be in the world. It's very hard to make a living when you've got no hope for the future. And so these things are all connected, aren't they? And I think that there's a healing that is offered to us at this time.
Thank you. Questions? Anybody got a question? There's somebody there. We're going to have... If you can keep your questions short, please, because we haven't got lots of time, and we'll answer as many as we can, or two or three. Thank you.
Paul, thank you very much. It's been incredibly enlightening. And for you to come down here and spend time with us, really appreciate that. You have talked predominantly about the UK. And, of course, the centre of Christianity started in Jerusalem, migrated to Rome, then Europe, and then America, and now centred in Africa. And I'm just wondering if you've got the same perspective of Christianity in some other countries apart from the UK. I mean, I'm very curious about Africa, obviously, but just curious, have you got any insights?
Yeah, thank you, Richard. I mean, two things to say about that. Let's stick to Africa, because Christianity is, there's a real vitality of Christianity, and it's astonishing what God is doing in the Muslim world, where it's so difficult, where, you know, this sort of gathering wouldn't be legal. Christians are under so much pressure, but yet the church is thriving and growing in all kinds of extraordinary ways. Muslims coming to faith, and it's such an incredible decision in those cultures for a Muslim to openly declare faith. They will lose everything. They'll probably almost certainly be completely ostracized by their family, disinherited, and yet the church is growing and flourishing right across the Middle East. It's quite extraordinary. I think another thing that you and I talked about, Richard, before the start, was that I'll just mention is, you know, during the history of my organization, this country sent thousands and thousands of missionaries out across the world. And not everything they did necessarily stands up to scrutiny, but, you know, most of the folk in the receiving countries are unqualified grateful that we came, even though, you know, there were complications, you know, so not necessarily the rest of the British government came, but the Christians came, the missionaries came, and you know, there's a giving back that's in many of their hearts. So, you know, part of the story of migration that you never hear in the media is the number of folk from across the world who come here because they believe God has sent them to come and help grow the church in Britain. And it's just an extraordinary thing that is going on, is the sort of the world coming here and going amongst the many, of course, diaspora communities that are around our cities, and Christianity flourishing in those places because of that reverse movement of missionaries in our generation. It's a remarkable thing. And I think, how can we learn as Christian communities to not lose our own particular traditions, but learn to sort of cross the boundaries into church that's done very differently by other communities, other denominations, communities from other countries that are worshipping Jesus here, but in different ways. And how can we allow that visibly to enrich our understanding of Jesus and Scripture?
The Muslim thing's really interesting because a number of us here are involved with ministry with some refugees who are here. 2 weeks ago, I was in a Bible study talking about Philippians 3, and in the middle of Philippians 3, Paul says, "Whatever was to my gain, I now consider loss compared to the surpassing joy of knowing Christ." And I'm talking to somebody who has lost everything to follow Jesus. I mean, we read this and think, yeah, that's really important, isn't it? But this person had lost family, had lost their home, had lost their livelihood, had lost their reputation because they believe Jesus is worth everything.
Yeah.
Wow. I thought I was so
challenged. It's a real provocation to us.
It really is.
Thank you, Paul, for a fascinating discussion and the report that I think just raises so many questions about how we as church respond to the opportunities that are present. I wonder if you could say a bit more about responding to, I guess, two types of people who might be attracted. They seem to sort of pop up in the conversation. One was the kind of Lamorna Ash type. That book was on your slide, a sort of individual. I'm going to try this out. I'm going to see if it's something I can express myself through. I'm going to go there as a consumer and kind of pick out a little bit of Christianity and maybe take the bits I like and not the bits I don't. And there's another type, which you kind of touched upon, I think, with the Jordan Peterson moment of a kind of, I want to make Britain great again. I want my civilization to just be wonderful like it might have been in my imagined past.
Yeah.
And I think you touched on the fact that both of those are stories which aren't gospel stories, and they're difficult challenges for us in terms of mission and discipleship. So maybe you could say a bit about either or both of those and how we as church can respond to those kind of groups, if you accept those are two reasonable groups.
Yeah, thank you. No, I do. I think that there will be a temptation for us to sort of try to rebuild something based on, some sort of return to a Christian narrative or Judeo-Christian values. And I think in and of itself, it's not bad, but what goes with it can be. And it hasn't got the life. That's the problem with it. And what people find is that, and we've seen this, that and the whole history of Israel tells us this, that if we have the values, if we have the laws, without the vitality, as human beings, we tend to turn it into something oppressive. They turned it into a legalism that wasn't God's heart at all, and it wasn't producing life. And that's the danger. It's not going to give life without the author. Right, so I think that's one thing. And then, you can't really, at one level, there's no reason for us to try to stop the, I agree with the way you've characterized the kind of consumerism, but I think it's genuine, right? I don't think it's an artifice. One of my colleagues at Bible Society interviewed Lamorna Ash. It's a really interesting interview on the Sacred podcast. Part of Bible Society is a think tank called Theos, and we run that podcast, which is all about talking to people on their sort of journeys. And I think that many people may not have arrived at a destination, but there's a genuine seeking. And I think there's a lot. I think we've got to be willing, as a Christian community, to take seriously the journeys that people are on and not force them artificially to reach an end, right? Because I think we can sometimes be like bad salespeople, you know, the classic car sales. We can be a little bit like bad salespeople where we always want to close the deal, And it's not helpful when people are really genuinely, deeply searching and asking questions and trying to find something. And we've got to be willing to be patient, I think, with that for a while. I know that eventually there's a moment, isn't there, when the Holy Spirit starts to provoke something. But let's not be too eager to get the answers buttoned down. Let people read the Bible and make all kinds of catastrophic errors and say heretical things. It doesn't matter because they're reading it and they're trying to find something. And I think if we can create space for that, that's going to be really significant for us. Because sometimes folk who are missing it in certain ways, but genuine, will see something that we've missed, and that can be powerful, right? But just allowing people the space is a way of expressing love to people. One of the things we're trying to do as Bible Society is work with a whole bunch of churches and innovators to create ways of doing Bible exploration that make room for that kind of active listening, where people aren't being trammeled into, here's the right answer to this, this is what the passage is saying you must do. No, let people explore it, because the Holy Spirit is our teacher and is able to bring light to people in the right way. So I agree with you again, that there's got to be, you can't do pick and mix Christianity, because in a way the let's just have the values is another version of pick and mix. It doesn't work without the full fat, but it takes people go on different routes. But I think this generation want full fat Christianity. They don't want the watered down version. And often our problem is that we water it down too much. We're a bit too embarrassed. We've got used to being embarrassed about Jesus, and we've got to get over that, haven't we?
I think that's why you were playing the long and winding road. That one, that could be.
Paul, thank you so much for your thoughts this evening. Just a question, sorry to ask, about politics.
Yeah.
What impact do you think the Quiet Revival might have on our politics? We've seen in recent years Tim Farron, no longer the leader of the Liberal Democrats. We've seen Kate Forbes not become leader of the SNP.
Yeah.
Many would believe that that was linked to the fact that they were Bible-believing Christians.
Yeah.
Do you think our politics will change, and is it possible potentially in the future for a disciple of Jesus to be a leader of a main political party?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it is possible. I think it is changing our politics. But I think we need to be very wary about that, because I think that what's happening, and I noticed this, you can imagine that when we launched the report, we did our press launch, we started off, as you know, most organisations would do, where every mention of the report in the media got clocked and, you know, catalogued, and it was all put into a database. And, of course, as chief executive, I would get sent a digest, and usually I would be sent one once a week, but I was getting them twice a day in the beginning of that. And eventually they just gave up because there were too many of these things. But what I noticed as I was reading was how the left interpreted the data in one way, the right interpreted the data in another way, you know. So you'd have, and even things that the report explicitly says aren't true were quoted as being true. Migration was a classic, right? So there was one group that wanted to say, "Oh, this is all about migration," and it was a negative. And then there was another group who wanted to say, "This is all about migration," and it's a positive. But actually, the report makes it clear that migration has had a positive impact on Christianity in Britain, but it nowhere comes near to explaining the magnitude of change we've seen, and that the majority of people coming to faith are from white backgrounds. What I'm saying is that different political ideologies tried to co-opt the report for their particular agenda, and I think that will happen. Right now, the people in power, the people running the media, the people in, you know, running political life, are in that Gen X cohort, right, where faith is at the lowest. And so that really affects the mood, doesn't it? Affects the way that things are reported, what gets excluded, what gets included. So we shouldn't forget that there is a built-in generational kind of lens often. It's harder for that to dominate because of social media, but nonetheless it's there. The last thing I'd say is, because you asked about whether it's possible for a Christian to lead a political party, and my answer is for sure yes. And I suppose, and be upfront about the Bible. But all I would say is, I hope that we don't get to a place where we feel that there's no cost to following Jesus. Because it doesn't do us any good. And it's done something good for the church in Britain to realize that there's a cost, a public cost, to being a true follower of Jesus. And so it's a double-edged sword, right? And faith is always, Christian faith, is always countercultural. And so if we think that our society, you know, Britain somehow, any nation for that matter, can be somehow baptized with the name Christian, and we kind of have arrived, then there's huge danger in that expectation, huge danger. And yet, I say that, I want to see revival and renewal through our land. Do you understand that there's a balance? It's a fine line. It's a fine line. So we need great maturity as leaders, because God never coerces us. We know this as individuals. So if we are in the position to influence, if we've got leadership roles, if we're in power, we better not be coercive with it, right? Because it's the antithesis of the way we're treated by God ourselves. It's got to be characterized by love. So I long for a deeper maturity in the church right now. Like, we go deep into the Bible, don't get too excited with the reports and get activist, but we go deep. We get closer to Jesus, right? Not more activist. That's my heart for this moment, I think. Great question, thank you.
We've got, is there any one more perhaps, or if not, Paul here, one more question. And then we'll finish, everybody. It's all right. Still time to dance.
Thanks very much, Paul, for this evening, and thanks to the authors of the report. I think it was absolutely fascinating. So my question is just, when do you think the quiet revival would be appropriately characterized as a loud revival?
Hmm. Yeah, one of the things I think a lot of people have wanted to turn up the volume, and I guess we're talking about it, so that's turned up the volume, hasn't it? Already, the very fact that it's now on the radar, not below the radar, because of course all this was happening, you know, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, before we finished the report. But one of the things I love about this is that nobody can own it, and I hope it stays that way. You know, it's not a particular church, it's not a particular leader, it's not some charismatic movement, it's not this expression, all that. You've got people coming to faith in Anglo-Catholic churches, in Catholic churches, amongst the Orthodox community, Pentecostals, Baptists, Brethren, Assemblies of God, you name it, people are coming to faith right across, and right across the country. And that, to me, there's something so beautiful about that, actually, in such a divided culture. It's happening everywhere, to every little community. There's something like this happening. We've all got stories. I hope it stays like that and just gets bigger, because I think it would be such a tragedy if, you know, one church, one leader suddenly had, you know, 10 times the growth of anyone else. And that became the story. Not because I begrudge that, but because I think it's great that we've all got the story, right? And it's not actually our story. We didn't. We were on a. I was interviewing on a platform about this topic in London 3 days ago with a Catholic priest from East London, real character, biblical preacher, and his church had gone from 1,000 to 5,000, and he had the Guardian down there interviewing him, and they were saying, right, so what's changed? What did you do differently? So how did you, you know, they were all wanting to understand. You must have done something differently. Why did the congregation suddenly change? And he sort of was reporting how he scratched his head and said, I don't think I did anything differently. I don't know what happened, really. Because the thing about Christianity is it's just really ancient. We just keep doing the same thing. It's just true. The world keeps changing around us. And I think there was something deeply beautiful about that, that he was acknowledging this is God at work, and he's at work bringing people into all the expressions of church across the country. What a wonderful thing that is. Long may that continue and grow.
Amen. Thank you, Paul. Thank you so much for that conversation. Would you like to give Paul a round of applause? Thank you.